So the focus today is on Tisha B'Av, the upcoming holiday of Tisha B'Av. Right? So that's the question, holiday. So first of all, we say like how we measure these things in Judaism sometimes is kind of funny. When you go to shul every day, like, are we saying Tachanun, right? So Tachanun is the prayer that comes after Shmona Esrei. We go down, and it's like we're beseeching God. It's like, you know, I'm a nothing, you know, God forgive me for all my sins type of thing. It's a very, kind of like, everybody, there's a certain joy when you don't have to say Tachanun. People have excuses, you know, anything you can come up with not to have to say Tachanun is a happy day. So it's like, it's something that you pick up when you go to shul on a daily basis. And so the funny thing about Tisha B'Av is it's a day that you don't say Tachanun. Why? Because it says, call upon me a moed. This is a holiday. So we were just talking about, like, how does that work? If it's a sad day, how can it be a holiday? How is that? How would we have elements of that? If anything, it's a day of mourning. So first of all, every holiday has a mitzvah. So the mitzvah of Tisha B'Av is avilah, which is mourning. So it then adds on to this question of how can there be then an element of something there of joy of some sort, not joy, but like a non-sadness, let's call it, in this mix, so to speak, of not having to say Tachanun. But again, it's because of the fact that it's called a moed in the book of Eicha. It says this idea that Karayalai Moed. So the question is, what is that? So we have to figure that out. So hopefully, by the end of today, we'll have some clarity on that idea, okay? But there is something that we're trying to accomplish. Every holiday, we're trying to accomplish something. What we're trying to accomplish on Tisha B'Av is through a mourning process to get to something, okay? Kind of touched upon it on Friday night a little bit. But we're not going to go. I promised you we'd talk about something different, right? So, but well, there is something of that in the answer to that. Okay. So before we get into the message, just to review some of the laws of Tisha B'Av. So Tisha B'Av, as opposed to the other fasts, there's one other fast that has this added element of not just fasting, and fasting means not eating or drinking. But there are five things that you're not allowed to do on Tisha B'Av, which would be basically analogous to Yom Kippur. And that is, we're not allowed to wash, we're not allowed to anoint, we're not allowed to put on creams, we're not allowed to wear leather shoes, we don't have no sexual relations, so again, Rechitza, Sicha, Nila, Sasandal, Tashma, Shamita. Right, so and also eating, right? So eating, drinking, washing, anointing, wearing leather shoes, and sexual relations. And this is basically the same thing that applies to Yom Kippur as well. Except Yom Kippur is clearly a happy day, the Day of Atonement, but Tisha B'Av ends up having these same restrictions. It also starts, this fast starts at night. Other fasts, besides for Yom Kippur, start in the morning, you know, at before sunrise. It's at daybreak, we'll call it. This starts at night. So this year, Tisha B'Av really is Shabbos. So we call it a Nidcha. It gets pushed to Sunday because we never, when it comes to happy things, we push it earlier. When it comes to things that are sad, we push it back. So it comes in Nidcha. So you don't. There's one time when we fast on Shabbos, which would be Yom Kippur, right? This does not take over Shabbos, but it gets pushed off. So come Shabbos afternoon, we'll have something called Tzudah HaMafseket, which is basically the last meal before. It's the Mafsek means to stop, to break. It's a break, right? So it's the meal that we use as a break that starts the fast. So we'll have that on Shabbos afternoon, late, and then from there, there'll be this tricky stuff about taking off your shoes before Maariv. We don't say Havdalah, so we'll say Baruch HaMavdil. We'll say we'll make this a blessing of separating between the holy and the mundane to be able to then take off our shoes, and so that we can't wear the leather shoes that we're wearing, right? And then sit down and say Eicha, and the day begins. And then here he talks about the idea that we don't study Torah because Torah brings us joy, but we'll be able to study the subject matters of things that relate to the day itself, things that are of, you know, like, it's interesting. One of the books that one can study is the book of Eov, of Job. So why would that relate? So again, it really talks about the idea of suffering. How do we relate to suffering in life and things of that nature? So you start to see, like, there's something about this day that, and really we commemorate all bad things that happened to the Jewish people historically. It's not just, like, for example, we have Yom HaShoah, but in certain more right-wing groups will say there's no Yom HaShoah. It is brought into Tisha B'Av because all bad things are commemorated on Tisha B'Av. And so it's a day of, you know, mourning of all historical bad things that happened to the Jewish people. It starts, when does it start? We saw last time the five things that happened on Tisha B'Av. The first thing that really starts puts the day in, starts the kind of the ball rolling in terms of negative things that happened on this day, was the sin of the spies. When the spies come back after 40 days in the land of Israel, they go around for 40 days, they come back on Tisha B'Av, and they give their negative report. And the report, this is about the idea of Lashon Hara, is that a lot of it, if you look on the surface, everything they said is true. But the way they spun it was negative. And then that the Jewish people also were at fault because they took the report, this negative report, and they received it and they cried. And so God says that you cried for no reason. I'll give you a reason to cry. Right? And that's really, right? And that's really the history.
It doesn't literally say that, does it? I'll give you a reason to cry.
Basically, the Talmud says, you
do that with your kids too. God's our father, now
right?
We
so he says, you cried here for no reason, and we call it Bechia Shal Chinam, which is an interesting code word, which is a crying for Chinam, which we have to analyze what that means. But here it would translate as wonton. I'm not sure what we'll see in a second. So let's see, we're going to try to, what I want to understand is, what happens going forward, which two temples were destroyed. There are two other things that happened on the day that the Talmud records. But I want to focus on the second temple's destruction, what caused it, and we'll focus on ourselves, what the Jewish people were responsible for. And then there's a very interesting Talmudic piece that I wanted to show in terms of also how, from God's perspective, of what God, let's say we look at like what we did wrong and then what God did, let's say, and understand some of that and then kind of bring it together. Okay, so let's see here. So it says in Talmud Yoma 9b, due to what reason was the first temple destroyed? It was destroyed due to the fact that there were three matters that existed in the first temple: idol worship, forbidden sexual relations, and bloodshed. However, considering that the people during the second temple period were engaged in Torah study, observance of mitzvot, and acts of kindness, and they did not perform the sinful acts of that were performed in the first temple, so why was the second temple destroyed? It was destroyed due to the fact that there was wanton hatred during that period. This comes to teach you that the sin of wanton, I don't know why they would translate chinam as wanton, but it's like baseless. A lot of times they call it baseless hatred, is equivalent to the three severe transgressions: idol worship, forbidden sexual relations, and bloodshed. Okay, so why was the second temple destroyed? Sinas chinam. Unnecessary or unfounded or baseless hatred or wanton. Okay?
Hate. Jews.
The Jews hated each other. They were treating each other with a certain hatred that was unwarranted. At least that's how the conventional understanding of this is. Now, just as a parenthetical, I just want to tell you, like, you have to always ask yourself, like, let's say today, more current, why did the Holocaust happen? So if someone came out and said the Holocaust happened because of X, Y, and Z, people go, like, who are you to say? So how do the rabbis come out and identify the reason for the destruction of the temple? Where do they get that from? Okay, it's like it would be as if coming out and saying that the Holocaust happened because of assimilation, because of Zionism, these are things that are out there. I mean, like the Sama Rebbe wrote a book called Vayom Moshe, and in there he says that the reason the Holocaust happened is because of Zionism.
Very
Zionism? Yeah. Now the truth is, you have to look at the way he formulates it and what was going on then in Europe. Let's just leave it as is. It's very hard to stomach. Okay, so maybe we'll do a share on that one time. I don't know. I have a lot of prep to do on that one. That's a tricky one. Okay, but where do the rabbis come to say that the reason the first temple and the second temple were destroyed for this reason? So, at the end of Parshas Yisro, what Yisro is known as the Parsha where
Ten Commandments,
or the revelation at Sinai. Okay, post the giving of the Torah's recording of the Ten Commandments, there's a little bit of description of the revelation, and they saw the sounds. They saw there was like lightning. It was like a light show, right? And they hear the shofar, and it's like smoke and all this other stuff is going on. And it says they said to Moses, "You speak to us, we'll listen. But don't..." God speaking is like, this is too much. We talked about this, overwhelming. Okay. So Moses tells the people, don't be afraid, because God is doing this as a way to test you, and that you should have the fear of God on you, and that you won't come to sin. And the people stood from afar, and Moses went to the abyss, or and he basically was there with God. And then it says like this, but God says to Moses, tell the people of Israel, you saw me saw the revelation. So no, don't do any idol worship. Do not have, lo sasu niti elokei kesef elohei zav elo sasu lachem. Don't make idols, right? So that would be idol worship. When you make a altar and you bring the different sacrifices to the altar, wherever my name is said, I will come and I will bless you. Okay? We'll see what that means in a second. When you make a altar of stone, don't make it with... You can't use any type of iron, any type of metal to hewn the stone. Okay? If you bring any type of metal onto this, it's no longer allowed to be used as an altar. Which would be what? Why wouldn't you be able to use something like that?
Weapon of war.
Correct, because it's a weapon of war. So you can't use metal. That's why she's... I invited Kathy, right?
But, so, for our
chocolate. So you have the idea. You can't use anything that's going to be related to worship of bringing sacrifices. You can't have any type of metal object associated with it, because metal equals killing. Okay? And then the last thing it says, and don't make... you can't go up steps to the altar, because you might reveal your erva, which is your private parts. Okay, so what is that?
Wearing a short outfit with your legs showing.
No, because when the Kohanim they went with like robes,
right?
So you have to. So what? But then we say that they wore, they wore undergarments. Okay, fine. But the idea is not to reveal the sexual, so it's a sexually related thing. So here is, at the context of post-revelation, God's presence, which is going to be now taken from Mount Sinai into the Beis HaMikdash, or into the tabernacle, God says, like, it's like a postscript. When, as you're leaving this event of revelation, of meeting God, I have a couple of points to make. Basically, don't do Avodah Zarah. Don't know idol worship. It's not on this thing. I should have put it in, but I ran out of space. But this is where it's... I'll tell you, it's chapter 20. It's Exodus 20, and it starts with 19 and it goes through 23. Okay, so it's chapter 20, 19 to 23. Perfect. So we have idol worship there mentioned, the idea of don't kill, because you can't use metal, no metal, and don't take big steps because it's going to reveal your private parts because that's related to sexuality. Okay, so now we see. Now when the rabbis see the destruction, there must have been other stuff going on at the first temple period, but the rabbis look at this and they say, if God's presence is going to be strong, especially in the temple, there are things that are not tolerated. Boom, right here. So chapter 20, Exodus 20, 19 through 23, they have something that they're looking at. They didn't just pull it out of nowhere. They see that God's saying, in my presence, I cannot tolerate these things. So therefore, destruction of temple one.
What's the fourth thing?
The fourth thing is, what do you mean, what's the fourth thing?
I thought you said there were four things.
So far there are three. There's right. A fourth thing. What's the fourth thing? The second temple. The second temple was destroyed for hatred. So now where do I see that in the sentences I just read you? So let me read you number 21. When you make a altar and you bring the different sacrifices, in all the places that I will mention my name, Avoi Lecha, I will come to you and I will bless you. I will bless you. So what is that referring to? The priestly blessing, with Birkat Kohanim. So Birkat Kohanim is predicated on what? So when the priest would get up, and they, even today when they get up, they make a blessing. Asher kiddushanu b'kedushaso shel Aaron, God sanctified us with the special sanctity of Aaron. Right? He commanded us to bless the Jewish people with love. Okay? It goes so far that if the Kohen has someone in the crowd that he does not get along with, he can't go up and bless. It's a halacha. There is a law that states that if the Kohen is not getting along with the people that he was going to bless, deals off, he shouldn't go up there. Okay.
Practically, that doesn't happen.
Practically, it does happen. A Kohen should not go up there and bless the crowd if they hate him, if they're in fight. There has to be.
Don is a Kohen. So if there's someone that you were in a fight with in shul, you theoretically couldn't get up and do the blessing.
And I went over to a guy who at one point I was upset at me, and I asked him. He said, "No, it's okay. We're good." Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
It's somebody physically in the presence of that Kohen, or is it just in general?
In that place, then you right. So you see this idea chapter 20, sentence 21, in this line here, where I'll bless you, in any place that I come to mention my name, I will come and I will bless you, meaning that this is what is the name being said? It's said in the temple. It's said in the tabernacle. That's the place of blessing. Blessing equals harmony, equilibrium, peace. So the rabbis didn't just pull this out and say, hey, you know, temple one was destroyed for these three things and the temple number two was because of this. It's because they saw here, when God's presence is, which we have in the temple, in the tabernacle, his concentrated presence, you have to have these things. If you don't have these things, deals are off, right? Temple one, that's why they said they just like make it up. They saw. So if someone came along and said the Holocaust happened because the Jewish people weren't getting along, okay, that might actually, you know, again, I'm not saying that. I'm not going there. But what I'm saying is that you see where they're taking it from. They're taking it from this fact that the Torah lays it out for us, predicate for having God's presence is you got to do these things. These are like, with all the other laws, here, this is like a no-go. No idol worship, no sexual impropriety, no killing, and you guys got to get along.
Well, it's interesting that it's not love between fellow Jew. It's love between the Kohen and the people.
But it's right. Okay, but yeah, but I said right. No,
I wasn't sure I wasn't sure where you were going with this initially. I thought it was, you know, love your fellow Jew.
Okay, but no, right. But that's good. I like that. That's a very good like clarification. But I think the idea is that it's yes, it's the representative with the people, so the representative has to get along with the people. Good. But I think it encapsulates, or it requires a greater, right, which is great. That's a very, I like that. That's a good point to have.
So, the thing with these mass shootings in the last 24 hours, and especially that's in the 9 days of baseless hatred, because of these shootings are specifically these two.
Hatred. It's hatred. I don't know. Like, again, we don't know. I mean, let's leave that. I was thinking about it, but
I don't know as much about the one in Ohio, but the one in El Paso.
Yeah, seemed to be very
Right.
So I want to let's hold off on the because
I want. We spoke about that.
No. So I didn't talk about it, but at something we'll get something like that. We'll see. Let's talk about. Well, we're going to talk about. I'm going to take it in a little bit of a different direction, and then we'll see. Okay.
Wanted just to add that I'm curious where this list came from. So there just happened to be a video posted on Facebook talking about how the non-Jew used to worship their gods, and there's the scene of the Jordan River coming down. And I actually went on that tour when I was in Israel with Larry. And you're watching basically where they used to have this animal worship. It was very, very anti-Israel. So it's like, oh, so that's where God got his red line, his bottom line from. Because of the way people used to handle themselves and conduct themselves with the animals, it was just so different from what God had told the Jewish people how they should behave in the temple and when they offered their sacrifice.
Okay, but like the idea you're saying of other worship.
Right, it was other worship.
Right.
Totally different from Jewish. It's almost like God said, you see what they're doing over there? You can't go there. And that's really where it came from, mm-hmm. just to be so different and so opposite from everybody else.
Mm, okay. All right. So now, just a parenthetical, we're going to be learning for the refuah of Asura Asnat Bat Alta Chaya. Okay.
Who's this?
Who is that?
Okay.
She's very sick.
Okay, wow. All right. So hopefully, now we have to really get serious.
Okay.
All right. But, okay, here we go. You have a sheet. Yeah, she does. Okay. All right. So now. So, we have Tisha B'Av. We're focused on the second temple because we're living post second temple destruction. So we're saying now that the reason why that second temple was destroyed, at least this is one reason that the Talmud is giving us, is because of baseless hatred, or at least that's how it's called sinat chinam, sina, hatred chinam. Okay, now. I'm translating it as chinam is baseless or wonton. I don't know what that means. I know that in Chinese food you get a wonton. That's all right. Right? So I'm like going food.
Is it like random? I should Google it. I don't have my phone.
Yeah, look it up. If you can look it up. But either way.
I don't have my phone.
We're gonna dissect. We have to understand what that means. Okay, that's what I want to understand. What does baseless or sinat chinam? What does it mean? Okay, so let's look at the next. This is a famous Talmudic piece that's studied universally on Tisha B'Av.
So it's the wanton is of cruel or violent action, in parentheses, but it says deliberate and unprovoked.
Deliberate and unprovoked.
So, yeah, so synonyms, right. Deliberate, willful, malicious, malevolent, spiteful, vicious, wicked, evil, cruel.
So there's something really negative to the word.
It doesn't. It does say.
And it's interesting. It's interesting that you had talked about forbidden sexual relations, and in the definition, it actually brings up wanton in regards to sexual relations, saying sexually unrestrained or having many casual sexual relationships, promiscuous, immoral, loose, immodest, indecent, shameless. So on such. So it's interesting that
Right, but this is the translator. So the translators decide. Okay, but I'm going to sinat chinam, baseless, unnecessary.
I like the baseless.
So okay, but let's see this Talmudic piece in Gittin. Okay, so this is universally studied. Gittin 55b. It's on Tisha B'Av. This has become like a very popular text that people study. Okay, apropos. Now this I start. This is the intro to the actual Talmudic piece. Apropos the war that led to the destruction of the Second Temple, the Gemara examines several aspects of the destruction of the Temple in greater detail. So that's the intro. Now the Talmud. Rav Yochanan said, "What is the meaning of that which is written? Happy is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief." Okay, we read that. This line is so important because this sentence from Proverbs is really defining the next couple of stories. We're going to just read one of the three because they're very long, and I try not to use too much paper. But you can read it. It's Safaria 55b, and keep on reading. You can see with the other two stories. But listen to this line again. Happy is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief. So what does that mean? A person should always be... Now, it doesn't mean to be afraid, fear, but a person should be kind of like on their toes. Happy is the man who fears always, is always like aware.
But it shouldn't be like fears God?
Could be fears God, but it's not just God, it's aware. I'm going to call it aware, okay? To be always on your toes and looking, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief. Meaning, it's like this, it's like you're contrasting these two ideas. The takeaway is, you should never get complacent. Right? Don't be complacent. Okay? That's how I would understand the sentence.
Yeah, but hardens your heart, it seems more to me that someone who's like turning their back or their mind from Torah and from the teachings of it. Like, because it's used another, to harden your heart is used a couple of times.
Right. No, so for sure. But I'm going to say within the way, I'm taking the way that happy is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief. I would just, in our words, the way we talk, is that the person who becomes complacent is a problem. Don't get complacent. Okay? Let's see what happens. Jerusalem was destroyed on account of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. The place known as the King's Mountain was destroyed on account of the rooster and the hen, and the city of Beit HaVikdash was destroyed on account of the shaft and from a chariot. Those two cases, I'll tell you outside, it's crazy. Like, it's just absolutely crazy. When you read the stories, you're going, oh my God, this is just so crazy. But let's see this first case. The famous case of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. The Gemara explains, Jerusalem was destroyed on account of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. This is as there was a certain man whose friend was named Kamsa and whose enemy was named Bar Kamsa. He once made a large feast and said to his servant, "Go bring me my friend Kamsa." The servant went and mistakenly brought him his enemy Bar Kamsa. Okay, so he makes this big party and his servant invites the wrong guy. The man who was hosting the feast came and found Bar Kamsa sitting at the feast. So his enemy's there. The host said to Bar Kamsa, that man is the enemy of that man. That is, you are my enemy. What then do you want here? Arise and leave. Bar Kamsa said to him, "Since I have already come, let me stay and I will give you money for whatever I eat and drink. Just do not embarrass me by sending me out." So here he goes. What are you doing here? Get out of here. It's like, listen, let's not make a scene. I'll pay for the cost of the meal. Let's keep it low-key. And what does he do? The host said to him, "No, you must leave." Bar Kamsa said to him, "I will give you money for half the feast. Just do not send me away." The host said to him, "No, you must leave." Bar Kamsa then said to him, "I will give you money for the entire feast. Just let me stay." The host said to him, "No, you must leave." Finally, the host took Bar Kamsa by his hand, stood him up, and took him out. Okay? So basically, kicks him out. After having been cast out from the feast, Bar Kamsa said to himself, "Since the sages were sitting there and did not protest the actions of the host, although they saw how he humiliated me, learn from it that they were content from what he did." So right, the fact that they saw this and didn't say a word. Okay. "I will therefore go and inform against them to the king." He went and said to the emperor, "The Jews have rebelled against you." The emperor said to him, "Who says that this is the case?" Bar Kamsa said to him, "Go and test them. Send them an offering to be brought in honor of the government and see whether they will sacrifice it." The emperor went and sent with him a choice 3-year-old calf. While Bar Kamsa was coming with the calf to the temple, he made a blemish on the calf's upper lip. Now, basically, what he did was he blemished it in a way that a normal person would not be aware of it, but it was enough that the Jewish people, would see, the people running the show there, would be like, I can't bring this. This is already a blemish. But according to them, Gentile rules for their offerings, it is not a blemish. Therefore, when Bar Kamsa brought the animal to the temple, the priest would not sacrifice it on the altar, since it was blemished. But they also cannot explain this satisfactorily to the Gentile authorities, who did not consider it to be blemished, right? So it was like a very subtle, right? He's like really like setting them up. The blemish notwithstanding, the sages thought to sacrifice the animal as an offering due to the imperative to maintain peace with the government, right? So they're saying, listen, the normal rule is that you can't bring this as a sacrifice because it's got the blemish, but you're going to sacrifice, no pun intended, you're going to sacrifice everything and get us into a war with the powers that rule for this. We can overrule that. We can actually take that rule and say it doesn't apply in this specific case. Rav Zachariah ben Avkula said to them, if the priests do that, people will say that blemished animals may be sacrificed as offerings on the altar. So Rav Zachariah ben Avkula says, listen guys, if we do that, then it's going to set the wrong precedent. The sages said, if we do not sacrifice it, then we must prevent Bar Kamsa from reporting this to the emperor. So they said, okay, wait, we have two options. So if we don't want to change the laws, we won't sacrifice it. People won't get the wrong idea, but we have to take care of Bar Kamsa. The sages thought to kill him, Bar Kamsa, so that he would not go and speak against them. Okay? Rav Zachariah said to them, if you kill him, people will say that one who makes a blemish on a sacrificial animal is to be killed. As a result, they did nothing. Bar Kamsa's slander was accepted by the authorities, and consequently, the war between the Jews and the Romans began.
Wow.
Okay. Wait, hold on. Let's see this last one.
The Crusades?
No, the destruction of the temple. The second, the temple. Okay, now. Rav Yochanan says, turn over. The excessive humility of Rav Zachariah ben Avkulis destroyed our temple, burned our sanctuary, and exiled us from our land. Okay, so now we need to understand what's happened here. Okay?
I just want to go back to one of the details.
Yep.
Did it make a difference between the calf's upper lip and the eyelids? Is that important?
No.
No.
So, but again, it was done in a way so that normal onlooker would say, there's nothing wrong with this. This thing is totally fine to be brought as a carbon, as a sacrifice, but it was enough of a sacrifice, it was enough of a blemish that for those who know...
It was a fine line.
Yeah, it was a very subtle... It's like basically someone from the jewelry business, right? I'm looking at this beautiful stone, and he looks and he goes, it's got the...
It's
right, 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 exactly. It's got this major thing inside. Fine, it's got a flaw. Okay, what happened in the story? Okay, again, we started the story by saying that don't become complacent. That was how I defined the verse from Proverbs. It's important not to become complacent. Don't like be you know don't like rely like and if, it would be like saying, however you see the world in a certain way, don't get caught up. Don't get stuck on things. When you get stuck on things, or when you're not willing to be flexible, or if you lack a certain flexibility, or if you're not willing to be open to looking at the situation from a bigger picture sometimes, you get lost in the weeds and the details, and that could also lead to bad things. Okay, so now how does that apply here? First of all, the question is like this. So now, let me tell you how people understand this. Normally,
is Bar Kamsa Jewish?
Yeah, these are Jewish guys.
Okay.
Kamsa and Bar Kamsa.
They have the same name.
I know.
That's the
so
whole
confusing. So
no, that's exactly exactly the point. The names are so similar. That's how things got all.
They made a mistake. They don't even talk about Kamsa. It's only Bar.
Right, it's Bar Kamsa.
Bar means son.
Yeah, but look what. Yeah, look
correct.
What
so there's a lot of. We're not even going to get into that stuff. We're not because there's a lot of different like you know on that you know Kamsa Bar Kamsa. What does Kamsa mean? Okay, we're gonna try to understand. Let's go back to the story.
I would love it if somebody did a research on Kamsa, the kind of character.
I'm sure it's
okay,
done.
But here let me ask you this question. I'll ask you.
Like a movie about those.
Right, yeah. I know. By the way, if you watch Aleph Beta by Foreman, he has a great video illustrating this whole story. I watched the last Tisha B'Av. It was really good and interesting.
Okay. What is? Let me ask you a question. Is Bar Kamsa a good guy or a bad guy? Okay. Again, the guy who ends up becoming embarrassed at this party. Is he a nice person? Is he a bad person? Let's take a step for a second. One second. Let me ask you a different question. The guy who wanted to kick him out, was he justified? Because the way we're looking at this story, this seems to be the story of baseless hatred. The guy was incorrectly invited to the party.
But then he offered to do all the right things.
Who, the Bar Kamsa guy? Did he do the right? Is that?
Or not the right things necessarily, but okay, so you made a mistake. At least let me.
So he's got money. So he's saying, "I'll pay. Listen, don't embarrass me. I'll pay it all. I'll pay you."
We don't know why they were enemies, though.
Right, but they're not. So we have this one snapshot of the party.
Right.
Then we have after the party. Okay. From what happens after the party. So now again, let's just take a step back for a second. When people read this story, they say this is baseless hatred. The way Bar Kamsa was treated was not right. And that seems to be the takeaway. Okay, that's how people read the story. Okay,
it's we don't know what he did though to Kamsa originally.
Whatever, we don't care. It just tells us.
People that hate other people.
Yeah, they hate. They don't. But that's how people read the story.
But we also say that if you embarrass someone, it's like you kill them. So that's a pretty serious thing that he embarrassed him.
Right.
Even if there was a reason.
If you embarrass someone. Oh yeah, Tom says that if you embarrass someone, it's as if you kill them. Like the idea of like persons like it becomes white like a ghost because you've killed them. Okay, but that's how people traditionally read this story. Okay, but that would be taking it out of context because you have to read the whole story. The whole story as you continue. If I were to say to you, is Bar Kamsa a good guy or a bad guy? What would you say? How has he acted after the event?
Well, because he was trying to...
He's a bad guy, right?
Yeah, because he's doing something that he knows the Jews cannot ultimately accept in the long run.
Right, he's looking...
He's
going
to see, like...
And it wasn't that he got a blemished sacrifice. He caused it to be blemished, knowing that the blemish that he did was this fine line that would cause stuff going on.
Correct.
So he was complicit.
He's a bad
guy.
The answer really is...
With the emperor.
Right, like, so the answer is...
He blew it out of proportion.
Okay, the answer is that actually Bar Kamsa is a bad guy, okay, and that people don't read this story correctly. Because what I just told, the way people read this and take this story, if you go to the guy on the street, you go to Beth Abraham or go to most Orthodox synagogues and you say, oh, the story of Bar Kamsa, oh yeah, that's Sinas Chinam. That's the idea of baseless hatred because they treated Bar Kamsa poorly. He didn't deserve it. And the answer is no. He did deserve it because he's a bad guy.
You do that to a bad guy who can do more?
Okay, ready? I'll tell you that he deserves it. He's a guy, I'll give you in today's, you know, he refused to give his wife a get. Now, should you kick him out of the party? Yeah, he's a bad guy, right?
Wow.
Okay? So let's say that's the scenario. He deserved to get kicked out. That's not the story. Because people are misreading the story. The real story is that the guy deserved to get kicked out, and it has nothing to do with his humiliation, and it has nothing to do with baseless hatred. What the Gemara is telling us, it started out and said, don't become stuck in your ways. When you get stuck in your ways, bad things happen. Don't become complacent. Don't get stuck on things.
Hold on.
So what's the story? Yeah. The story is that at the end, when it comes to the temple and they're deciding, should we bring the sacrifice or not bring the sacrifice? So this Rav Zecharia ben Akulis, right? Mm-hmm. And this is what Rav Yochanan said. It's because of Rav Zecharia ben Avkulis's excessive humility, which basically means like he got it. He was like he wasn't thinking straight. That's why everything got destroyed. The story is nothing to do with Kamsa being treated. The story really is that how this rabbi said, "Whoa, the rules are." He got stuck. He couldn't see the fact that. Don't you understand? The whole Beis HaMikdash, the temple is going to be destroyed, and you're getting stuck on this little point of this is how it's done. the blemish. Mm-hmm. He couldn't. He was so rigid in his way of thinking that he couldn't get past that. So the real story is not to do with Bar Kamsa being embarrassed, because Bar Kamsa was a bad guy. He should have been kicked out. Okay? Most people do not read it this way, but that's because they don't read the entire Talmudic piece. Oh. The Talmudic piece is starting, and it says, Rav Yochanan starts and says, and gives us this header, "Happy is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief." Right? If you who's it talking about? It's talking about Rav Zechariah ben Avkulis is the one who's being criticized here.
The story's not about the...
It has nothing to do with Kamsa. I know.
And everybody talks
and everybody reads it that way, and they're misreading the Gemara. Okay?
So if everybody's misreading the Gemara, then they're not learning the right thing.
That's right, because they're not, because they're taking it out of context.
Yeah, but there was complete...
Okay?
You've got to have a whole show on that.
There was complacency on all the different levels. First, the sages were complacent that he was throwing the guy out. Like, there was
right, so that's people. Right. So the answer is, no, but it could be that the guy. The answer is that the guy was a bad guy. We see that he's a bad guy. The way he did, the way he set the Jewish people up, shows that he was a jerk. Okay, he deserved to get thrown out of the party. The criticism is on Rav Zechariah ben Avkulis. Destroyed our temple. He burned our sanctuary. He's the guy who's responsible because of the way he did not react properly, because he became stuck in his ways.
Right.
Okay.
But we're so blaming him. So first of all, he didn't know that it would lead to the destruction of the temple.
The answer is that no. The point is that he should have known, and he didn't look at the big picture.
Right.
That's the criticism. Rav Yochanan is coming.
That's all. He did know because somebody said to him.
No. So, right. Exactly. Right. So right. So the Gemara. So no one reads this Gemara properly. Rav Yochanan is coming and telling us this thing. If you read the Gemara and you step back, and Rav Yochanan is saying the excessive humility of Rav Zechariah ben Avkulis destroyed our temple. He burned our sanctuary and exiled us from the land. Because that's exactly how the Gemara starts. The Gemara says, don't harden your heart to fall into mischief.
Yeah, but if I don't disagree with you, if those sages sitting there when he was getting thrown out of the party would have said something at the time, because they were also complacent.
No, but that's not... No, because
you wouldn't have done the whole thing.
No, but that's not... But again, Rav Yochanan's not... That's not... Rav Yochanan is not saying that. That's exactly what the trap is. That's what most people read the Gemara. They say what you're saying.
You have to go tell everybody.
Well, that's okay.
They'll have to listen
okay.
to
I promise you that Jonathan's not the only guy saying this.
It's also
right.
I think we should go back to another sentence. The sages thought to kill him, so he would not go and speak against them. I think that's a big issue here.
No, so again, but the point is, Rav Yochanan does not criticize them. He's criticizing the guy who was saying, "Don't act," because we're going to get the wrong impression. People are going to take the takeaway is going to be you're setting wrong precedences, right? So then you have exactly okay. So therefore, if we're reading this Gemara the way we're reading it, the truth is, if you look, it's worth looking at the second two cases. It's crazy. I'll give you one of the cases. They had a tradition that when children were born, they would plant a tree.
Right.
And then the trees would be used 18 years later, when they were 20 years later, or 25, whatever, when they got married, they would take those trees, the wood from that, and they would use it for the celebration of the wedding. Okay? Come the Romans, the daughter of the emperor, whatever it is, and they're coming through town and they knock down one of the trees. So what do? They go crazy.
The Jews go crazy.
Okay. And that's what led to the destruction of a whole city. Because they couldn't, like, hello, I understand the sentimental value of the tree, because it's like, you know, it was planted when the kid was born, and now, oh my gosh, but like, really? You're going to upset the mega power of the Romans, which is going to lead to the destruction of the entire city? All life will be lost because of the sentimental value that you put into a silly tree? Really? That's the second story.
Even wow. We do that with our children. We'll fight about something.
We get crazy, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. The Gemara is saying. So the Gemara is saying that what happened with the breakdown at the second temple was that we got stuck on sentimental chinam, actually, what I'll say now, sinas chinam, was the sinna, the hatred came from being attached to sentimental things that are silly. That was the problem. The hatred was coming from chinam, which is getting attached to things based on sentimental value. And it's crazy. Like when you see that case, that's you read the story. Right? So that's, but so it's so not baseless. So
you're kind of defining what they mean by baseless.
But yeah, but it's different. But it's, right di- but it's a completely different, it's a very different wrinkle.
No, I understand, but you're almost.
That's decaf, that's regular.
You're almost defining it, though. You're almost defining what that means.
Right, but right. So but what we're, so now what we're saying is it's very important. And we are, and the reason why the Beis HaMikdash, after the first temple's destruction, was 70 years, and they got back, because they corrected it. They were involved in idol worship. They were involved in sexual impropriety. They were involved in killing. 70 years, they fixed it. It's 2,000 years since the second destruction of the temple, second temple.
We still haven't fixed it.
Right. Why? Because we still have these issues where we get stuck on these things. We become sentimentally connected to things. And we get so attached that, like you said, it brings us to hatred. It's baseless hatred because of sentimental attachment to stupidity. Okay? Now...
Schools do
that all the time. All the time. I was thinking about all the politics. But so, I, so true. That's why we don't have a
Correct.
They're working on it, though.
Where is Hashem's hand in all of this, though? Like,
not involved in history.
Okay. So no. So that's why I your question is No, no.
No, your question is
next. That's the next. That's the next. All right. So I did a good job.
Did he pay you?
When you talk about somebody's heart being hardened or somebody's treating someone inappropriately, doesn't have the right humility, is that Hashem placing that there because all this was meant to be, or is this
no, there's hatred in the world.
No, so okay, so let's so I purposely it's a good setup, it was good.
Yeah, there was.
No, it's excellent. Question. Now I'm gonna do the last thing first and then I'll go back to that Rashi.
I also need to know that the rooster and the hand.
No, so that's where you'll go. No, so you'll go. No, no, no. So look at no, no. It's all the same thing. Right. So you go to getting. There's Safaria, great app, has English translation of the Talmud, and you just read the story. It's all there.
Safaria.
That's. I'll leave that for homework at home. Okay. Safaria, getting. You go Talmud. You go Talmud, getting 55b. Just read. It just goes. Okay. It's a long, nice, great chapter. Okay. So I'm going to skip now to Talmud Bava Kamma 60b, one of my favorite Gemaras of all time. I learned this like 30 years ago. I fell in love with this Gemara, okay? And then we're going to look at Rashi, which is really the first Rashi in Hall of Chumash, okay? But let's first look to answer your, to address your thing, Hallie. We're going to Talmud Bava Kamma 60b. Rav Ami and Rav Ashi sat before Rav Yitzchak Nafcha. One sage said to Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha, let the master say words of halacha. And the other sage said to Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha, let the master say words of agadah. Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha began to say words of agadah, but this one sage did not let him. So he began to say words of halacha, but the other sage did not let him. Basically,
what's the difference between agadah?
Okay, agadah. Okay, so halacha is like the right?
The
okay, good. Agadah is more of the, it would be the, what's the word in English? The story or the more of the esoteric ideas. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one's more like halacha, right? The laws tell me what to do. The other one's more conceptual ideology. Okay, so Rav Yitzchak Nafcha, every time he tried to do one, the other guy would stop. So what Rav Yitzchak Nafcha said to him, I will relate a parable. To what can this be compared? It can be compared to a man who has two wives, one young and one old. The young wife pulls out his white hairs so that her husband will appear younger, and the old wife pulls out the black hairs so that he will appear older. As it turns out, he is bald from here and from there, completely bald due to the actions of both of his wives. Right? So basically, he loses... What's funny is, that's not even the message of the Gemara, but there's a guy, I was looking it up yesterday, and someone just goes into the whole thing about whether allowed to take your, whether they're allowed to pull out hairs or something like that. I'm like, I don't know, well, that's not the message of the Gemara, fine. But he used that as an opportunity to discuss that, but that's nothing to do with the message here. Fine. Rav Yitzchak Nafcha continued and said to them, If so, I will say to you a matter that is appropriate to both of you, which contains both halacha and agada. Right, so he's going to basically kill two birds with one stone. In the verse it states, if a fire breaks out and catches it in thorns, so the term breaks out indicates that it breaks out by itself, right? It's on its own. Yet, the continuation of the verse states, the one who kindled the fire shall pay compensation, which indicates that he must pay only if the fire spreads due to his negligence. But you see this idea that at first the verse is saying it happened on its own, right? The fire went. But then it holds the person who started the fire accountable, okay? The Talmud, just as a side, important idea here, is that the Talmud spends a lot of time trying to figure out how do we look at a person starting a fire in terms of it goes and damages people. Do we hold them accountable as if he directly damaged it or indirectly damaged it?
Are you saying there's a spark that jumped out of his own fire? Is that what it
basically Yeah, yeah. Means? Basically goes, he starts something that in turn the fire then goes to the guys next door and
like
burns down.
Jumped.
Yeah, okay. So how do we look at it? Do we look at the fact that he started the fire as being a direct result? Like as if I went to something and I hit it directly or indirectly? And the practical ramification was in terms of damages. If I directly damage something, not only do I pay for the damages, I pay, for example, if I actually injure someone, I have to pay for the medical, I have to pay for their lack of their disability, I have to pay for their, medical disability.
Loss of wages.
That's disability. Any type of embarrassment that might have happened to them. That's if I damage them directly. But let's say it's my possession that damages them, I would only have to pay for the actual damage, none of these extras. So that's a practical thing. Do I say indirect or direct? If it's direct, I have this whole laundry list of things. I got a medical disability, all this stuff, and embarrassment on top of, okay?
Punitive damages.
There you go, okay? Whereas if it's just like my possession, like my animal went, and I'm not held, I don't have to pay all those extra things.
Yeah.
Okay. So which way? So the Gemara goes back and forth. It defines direct as isha mishum chitzo, the fire because of a arrow. That's actually looked at as the direct.
Burning arrow?
No, not burning. It's just like as if I shoot you with an arrow, it's as if I directly damaged
uh-huh.
you.
Okay.
But it uses that analogy because, again, it's not like me coming and punching you in the face because I'm not punching in the face. We recognize the fact that it is an indirect thing, right? Yes or no? You're giving me this look like you're like,
oh, no.
Okay.
I don't get it.
Okay. Again, just understanding fire, it does damage. We're just trying to analyze how do we look at the fire. The fire's damage, the person who started the fire is definitely held accountable. Mm-hmm. Just how do we look at the person? Is he directly responsible or indirectly responsible? And we said, practically speaking, if it's direct, you got not just damage, but all the other things, medical, disability, etc.
Okay.
If it's indirect, you just have to pay for the damage, and that's it, no extras. Okay. The way the Talmud describes that is, the direct is looked at as if you shot an arrow, because that's direct, I'm directly impacting you, as opposed to mimono. Eishem Mishem mimono is my property. I indirectly damage you through property. My property is the thing. My car damaged. Although,
okay. You set the parking brake, the car rolled down.
Correct. Good.
Right.
Okay. So now, he says like this. Yet the continuation of the verse states, the one who kindled the fire shall pay compensation, which indicates that he must pay only if the fire spread due to his negligence. The verse can be explained allegorically. The Holy One, blessed be he, said that although the fire broke out in the temple due to the sins of the Jewish people, it is incumbent upon me to pay restitution for the fire that I kindled. Now we have God coming in here. Listen to what it says. I, God, kindled the fire in Zion. As it stated, the Lord has accomplished his fury. He has poured out his fierce anger, and he has kindled the fire in Zion. which has devoured its foundations. This is what we're going to read in Lamentations on next Sunday, or next Saturday night. Okay? The Lord has accomplished his fury. He has poured out his fierce anger, and he has kindled a fire in Zion, which has devoured its foundations, and I will build it with a fire in the future, God says, as it stated, for I, says the Lord, will be for her a wall of fire round about, and I'll be the glory in her midst. So that's from Zechariah. So God basically saying, I destroyed the temple with fire, and I will rebuild it with fire. So now,
why is he saying that?
Okay, so now, let me ask you a question. Let's take a step back. Forget about what we just read. We're at the second temple, at the end there, and we see what happened. Did God burn the temple? No.
No.
He didn't burn the temple. The Romans burned the temple. So,
how do we know?
Maybe, what do you mean?
Maybe he sent the
wrong. So now what it's saying in Eicha, in Lamentations, is saying, you might have thought that that's them. No, that's me. They're just my messengers. Okay? Similar to fire, right? I start a fire here, and it goes to the next guy's yard and burns down his house, right? Who burnt his house? Well, it wasn't me. It was the fire, right? That's what it looked like. But no. Wow. The answer is no. I lit the fire. So I'm the guy who burnt down his house. So you might have thought the same. So that's the analogy. The analogy is saying, you saw the Romans come and destroy it with fire. No, that was God. Wow. And the same thing, that the same way that the temple was destroyed that way is the same way that will be rebuilt. You hear? So meaning it's like you're going to see it being done by outside forces. No, that's God. Okay, so you can almost say like today, what's happening in the land of Israel is God rebuilding it. So you might say, where's God? No, that's exactly the point. Just the same way that it was destroyed that way is the same way that it's going to be rebuilt. Through intermediaries.
Just taking a lot longer.
Through intermediaries. Okay, but it, yeah. Now the morale...
But why fire?
So the morale... it's good. So there are two things. One on the simple level is that this idea that fire has this quality of where it looks like it's acting on its own, but it's really the person who started it that's the responsible party. So use that. So how can I describe or how can I express God being involved indirectly or directly? Fire is the best way to use that as an analogy. The morale says, additionally, he says that idea, but he also says the idea of fire is the intensity. So that this power of fire. Uh-huh. And so that would happen there at the destruction is this powerful thing. So too, again, the flip side will be that when the Torah, when God willing, when the temple is rebuilt, there's going to be this analogy to fire, indirect, but also the power of fire.
Well, you got all the buildings that were built on where the temple is.
What do you mean? That
where the temple was.
Was, right?
Now.
Right, there's all this other stuff. You're saying?
You can't build a temple there.
Okay, so the answer is it's gonna work. We're going to see that it's going to be, it will happen. God willing.
Yeah, right? In our time.
Well, hopefully in our time. Exactly. Yeah. That's a, you know. Okay. So just as, and then it finishes off and it says this idea that you see, he shows this halachic. And there is a halacha that can be learned from the verse in Exodus, as the verse begins with damage caused to one's property. If the fire breaks out, again, concludes with damage caused by one's body. The one who kindled the fire. This indicates that when damage is caused by fire, it is considered as though the person who kindled the fire caused the damage directly with his body. That serves to say to you that the liability for his fire damage is due to its similarity to his arrows. Just as one who shoots an arrow and causes damage is liable because the damage is caused directly through his action, so too, one who kindles a fire that causes damage is liable because it's considered as though the damage were caused directly by his actions. Okay? So that's the halachic piece, that the idea that when you start a fire, you are held accountable and you have to pay all the things. You got to pay not just direct damage, you got to pay the medical, you got to pay the disability, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But back to this thing, the idea of using this analogy of fire for God and the temple is the fact that even though it looked on the surface that God was not directly involved, he very much is the one who's responsible. so too, God willing, the rebuilding. But to answer your question that we started with, where's God in this whole thing? Okay? So the answer is that God is definitely at play behind the scenes, but it's both sides. God is giving us space. He always gives us space and is continuously giving us space to go and do the right thing. But when we don't do the right thing, there are consequences, right? So God is saying, here's the rope, guys. What are you going to do? Are you going to hang yourselves or not? And that's, but God is there as a parent, you want to say, and he's going to say, if it's not working properly, he's going to have to get involved and destroy things. We were happy. Now, the question they always ask is basically the temple started burning in the afternoon on the 9th and burned through the 10th. So why do we keep Tisha B'Av? Why do we have it on the 10th? The 9th, it should be on the 10th because most of the temple burned on the 10th. Everybody asked that question. So some will say, this whole analogy, if it's all about fire, it's all about when it starts, because it's all right. We see that God started the fire, so to speak. So when it started, that's why. And so the fact that it burns continuously after that, that's secondary, right? So that's, you know. The others say, Ray Rosner, we just heard him on Wednesday night, whatever it was, he said a beautiful idea that we didn't know how God was going to kind of punish. We thought it could have been us that was really going to get wiped out. The fact that he took his fury out on a temple of stones and wood and not on us, that's kind of also like a little bit of that silver lining that we have in the cloud here. Because the fact that he burnt the temple said, okay, I'm going to take it out on this building and you guys will be spared. That was already a certain silver lining, a cause for like, phew. And that's why if you see in the day of Tisha B'Av itself, as the day, when we get to midday and onward, things kind of get more relaxed in terms of the morning. We start getting up on chairs. Things just feel more relaxed. Now, wait, the burning just started. No, that's exactly the point. At that point, we saw that God was taking it out on the house and not on us. Whew, okay, we dodged a big bullet.
Is that
okay.
Why there's no
tachanun? Well, there's more. There's that. The reason there's no tachanun is because it's called the moed. Mm-hmm. And it's called a holiday. That's already caused. That's like on the most basic level. But there are, to answer, I'll come to that in a second. Okay, all right. So now, what is the takeaway? Okay, this is the major important thing. It's a day of mourning. Avelus, this is what we talked about on Friday night a little bit, is that when we come to mourning, Avelus has the word aval, but. We think a certain way, we get caught into sentimentality of things, which is the cause for bad things. That's what Rabbi Yochanan is saying. We get stuck on things. We become connected. We become emotionally attached to ideas. And then we can't get to the next step. Avelut and the moed of the celebration of, or the holiday of the, is the avelut, is the mourning. Because what it gives us the ability is to get things properly put into perspective. Right? So I get caught up and stuck in things. When we come to a place where we lose, to the point where we come face to face with death or with destruction, it gives us the ability to take a step back and say, wait a second, boy, did I see this wrong. Avelut, when it's translated into Aramaic, aval, is kushta, it's truth. Kushta means truth, right? Aval, truth. Avelut gives us the ability to see things really for what they are. And so when we come to Tisha B'Av, the day is about getting back proper perspective, right? So a lot of times we have our priorities in the wrong place, right? On a personal level, as a community, and when we have like tragic events like you're talking about, so that hatred, horrible, right? But when we see that, we're going, what the heck? You know, like all this political banter back and forth and this, everybody has to take a step back and say, priorities in terms of what's important in life. And, you know, and to quote Ray Rosner again, there are really three things that are going on. I never understood this. I always looked at it as the destruction of the temple is destruction of our relationship with God. But there are other things that are lost, and that is the relationship of we as a people. It was a place that we all came together. The Beis HaMikdash was a place that we came together three times a year. It was a unifying force that was there that was lost. We no longer had. Today, thank God, it's slowly coming back. This is what you're seeing. The fact is, Jerusalem, Israel, is a place that's bringing the Jewish people back together. That's the redemption. This is the fire. It's coming in directly. It's happening. God willing, it should continue and go. It's not. We haven't gone to the place of like, wow, we finally are completely redeemed. But the redemption thing is happening because the fact that we lost the place of unification, we're getting slowly back. It's happening. It's still missing. We still have issues of where we're getting sentimentally attached to stupidity as a people, as a community, as individuals. We are all guilty of this, of getting sentimentally attached to silly things. And so comes the holiday, I call it the holiday of Tisha B'Av, is Avelot, is the time for it to like smack us in the face, boom. We lost, we had a Holocaust, we had horrible, all those things come into one. We were chased, we had pogroms, we had all these horrible things in history. Those were all wake-up calls to help us somehow get out of our sentimental attachments to whatever stupidity we... It's always been like that.
Yeah, but you can't call a pogrom or a Holocaust a wake-up call. I mean, people
Why not?
Were massively murdered.
Yeah, yeah. So as a people, we suffer. How do you explain suffering? So we say, Baruch Dayan
Ha'emet. That's hatred. Like, that's...
Again, what we say is, we recognize in our smallness, God has a reason for these things. I don't understand. What I do say, though, is I bless God and say, blessed is the Dayan Ha'emet, is the judge of truth. Because whatever's happening, I don't necessarily understand at the moment, but I know that God's doing it for a good reason. So I don't, again, I'm not saying why, saying it's for a reason, and for somehow, at the end of days, we'll see but it's about getting us going forward, and that's the avail. That's the mission of the day, is to help us get some type of perspective back in the proper way. And let me just end with this, okay? This Rashi here. In the beginning, the first Rashi in Torah starts, it should have started with the first mitzvah, and it starts with the creation story. Why? And so it says here, what is the reason then? It's the third line. What is the reason then that it commences with the account of creation? Because of the thought expressed in the text, he declared to his people the strength of his works. He gave an account of the work of creation in order that he might give them the heritage of the nations. So the idea of creation, and then Rashi then transitions into talking about the land of Israel. What? Creation, the land of Israel? How does that go? Like, how do you jump from one A to B? That's what Rashi's saying here. What is the reason that he commences with the account of creation? Because of the thought expressed in the text, he declared to his people the strength of his works and gave an account of the work of creation in order that he might give them the heritage of the nations, which is the land of Israel. How does that go? And then, of course, it says, for should the people of the world say to Israel, you're robbers of the land, which they do every day at the UN, we'll be able to say that God, the Holy One, all of the earth belongs to the Holy One, blessed be He, created it and gave it to them to whom He pleased. When he willed to give it to them, and when he willed, he took it from them and gave it to us. But what does that have to do with anything? So the answer is that the creation is the beginning. It's this idea of renewal. We have to constantly be a state of renewal. What goes wrong on Tisha B'Av and what happens, all the suffering, is because we get stuck in not willing to become people of renewal. We get stuck in sentimental ideas of old. And the answer of our connection to the land of Israel is God's creation. The creative act is the idea of constantly being willing to renew how we look at things and to grow. And we get stuck in the old and we don't get past ourselves to get to the next step. Hold on a second. So Tisha B'Av is the idea of new perspectives. And also wake up call to say, okay, guys, whatever it is that we were stuck in, to get past it and to move forward, to get tap into the power of new, the power of renewal, of being able to always pick ourselves up and say, I can recreate myself, read this, read that, reamp, redo, and grow, because God's looking for us to grow, and we get stuck. We don't want. That's what, remember this line? It says here in Happy is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief. That's exactly the point. We get stuck in those. We harden our hearts. We get stuck in not willing to go past. And that's what Tisha B'Av is. Tisha B'Av is a day when we're supposed to get past the old stuff and be able to tap into the power of what Rashi's saying, the first Rashi, back, getting back into the power of creation, of renewal, and of all those the awesome. Next steps.
That's a very modern Orthodox way of thinking. I mean, what about the people that are very stuck in their ways?
So I'm not saying we have a Torah. The Torah prescribes for us how we're supposed to act. So in that, even in that, so people are getting, we all in our different, wherever different shades of where we are, whether you be all the way from the left, all the way to the right and everything in between, everybody has this issue. But it's not unique to you or to me or to the guy sitting in Lakewood or Bnei Brak. Everybody, we all get stuck.
Yeah, but I was thinking more in terms of brotherhood and Jews looking at each other as fellow Jews instead of, you know, they're
right. So the answer to that is we all look and judge everybody else. From the left to the right, and everything in between. And the answer is, yeah, the work of all of us is to see fellow Jews.
And you're right, because if that was all resolved, we have the third temple. That's the point.
But the answer is one step at a time. The idea is to break down those barriers to the perceptions and things like that. And
who does that?
It's being done.
I think
it's being done.
I think Jay Inspire does it, and I think JWRP and Momentum does it. I if you asked me pre this trip if I would be sitting studying in Orthodox, the first time I went to the Aish convention, I was like. And I had just come back from Israel, and he hadn't gone yet. I said, I called my daughter. I'm like, you're not going to believe where I am. And I'm like looking around, but I feel very accepted by. I don't right, feel excluded.
But that's no. So, but that's
starting with us.
So that that's we're the answer, right? So something. This is the answer. So I like if people right. ask me yeah, like about the like, stuff, I don't look at. If someone says, "What do you accomplish being involved in this?" And the answer to me is very simple. It's opening up. And creating connectivity between Jews. That's the answer.
But we need more.
Of course, that's so you gotta start. So where do you start?
You start here.
You start at home, and we've started.
And hopefully, somebody else takes it.
100%.